district is making the statement.
And this isn't why it's a good book, but it's very complimentary about
this is tape two of the conversation with Mr. Whitney Young, April 29. Proceed. Now, you were going to say something about the split between lower class Negro life and upper class Negro life. First, the economic split you were talking about, and now the matter of the spiritual split. Is it widening or narrowing?
Well, two things are happening. On the one hand, there is a greater sense of pride in race, and there is a solidarity as far as goals are concerned. But there has developed and is developing this gap on an economic basis that sets up social and geographic distances. And in the North, it poses another problem in that the ability to communicate and to understand common goals and make common calls was much greater in the South, where regardless of the affluence of an individual Negro or his education, he was still denied the same things that a poor Negro. So the poor Negro and the middle class educated Negro could make common cause easily, and this brought a sense of restraint and balance and everything else to the groups seeking its rights. Now, when you get to the North, because the Negro of affluence can, in most cases, and increasingly so, escape in the sense that he can move away from the ghetto, he can go to the theaters, he can go to the restaurants and the schools, the better schools, it makes the identification of the common cause between the lower class Negro and the middle class Negro much more difficult to identify. Now, this what this means is that the lower class Negro in the North can say, or at least be suspicious, of the intervention of the middle class Negro, and he makes it much more difficult. He makes him prove why he is involved in civil rights, why is he concerned about it. This means that many Negroes who aspire to get involved become discouraged because they aren't warmly and immediately accepted by the masses. And it also means that the ambitious demagogue, a rabble-rouser in the lower class, is able to influence and the masses easier and to discredit responsible Negro leadership.
Now, yes, you answered my question at the tip of my tongue. The great problem of leadership that is caused by this fact, that's a real danger, isn't it?
This is a real danger, especially as long as the climate is so fraught with poverty and with the type of conditions that would make demagoguery easy. As long as there is mass unemployment, as long as there is poor housing and all of this, this makes a natural breeding ground. The arguments are so plentiful. Also, the Negroes have learned through observation of the Southern demagogue how he has exploited the fears and the ignorance of poor white people using race as a factor. We watched Bill Bow. He saw him. He listened to him. He saw Gene Talmadge with his red suspenders do the thing. And now that Negro who's opportunistic, he simply uses what he has learned so well in the South and has seen to exploit and to capitalize on the impoverished, illiterate, unemployed Negro.
Has this led to a serious cracks in the bids for power, in leadership, in terms of bids for power, do you think?
It's made it much more difficult for responsible leadership to intervene and to get the emotional response of the masses of Negroes. But I think another thing in that picture is that the mass media has either, I hope unconsciously, not consciously, they have helped in the build-up of the demagogue.
I read your speech.
Yeah. And this, you see, is, in effect, the only person that the masses see on television, on the front pages of the newspaper, speaking for their hopes and their dreams and their aspiration, is a demagogue. And this contributes to this inability or the difficulty of the responsible leader getting the confidence and even getting the awareness of the masses that he is working in his behalf.
What do you think of the remark that one encounters now and then, that the people who should be most alarmed about Malcolm X are the Negro leaders, responsible Negro leaders, and not whites?
No, I disagree with this. I think the people who should be most alarmed are white people, because a Malcolm X is but a symptom. There are many Malcolm X's around. People who have a genius for cussing out white people, and we will have many more developing. This is a symptom of an evil and a frustration and a feeling of despair and hopelessness in a society. And it seems to me that it reflects the feelings of white people. The other thing is that white people will temporarily buy or will even find interesting and amusing and certainly newsworthy a Malcolm X, not because they really feel that he can mount a massive military activity against them, but because he is preaching a kind of separatism and a kind of Negro self-help and isolation, which many white people find very appealing, and there's a lot of wishful thinking. What they forget is that Hitler was able, and Mussolini were able, to develop great efficiency and build roads and hospitals by preaching hate, and that eventually this hate will turn against people. But Negroes per se find Malcolm X entertaining. They get a vicarious pleasure out of hearing him curse out white people since they've been kicked around all day. And they are quite amused by the way the white press and the white community seems to get aroused, and this tickles them, how he can get front page coverage and he can scare people and all of this. But the Negro community, wouldn't 10 people follow Malcolm X to a separate state?
Not to a separate state.
No, even if America gave him one, and Africa doesn't want our caseload, welfare load, any more than New York wants it. They want chemists and physicists and engineers. So they aren't fixing to open up their doors to impoverished Negroes of New York.
What would you say to this remark by Adam Clayton Powell, that the leadership of all the old line organizations is finished? They have no political, no significance anymore.
Well, I think this...
Count the votes, he says. 900,000 is the biggest you could think of in your wildest dreams. The source of votes, 12,000-14,000 available elsewhere to other kinds of organizations and other kinds of impulses.
Well, I think here again, Mr. Powell is reflecting in his attack on national Negro leadership his frustration at his own inability to reach this kind of national status. He would like a great deal to be seen not as just a leader of a district here in New York City, a Harlem leader. He would like to be seen as a national leader, and he's been constantly rejected in this role. And I guess the climax to this, and this is what really started, set this thing off, was a march on Washington, when Adam Powell managed to even get in the pictures and was not called upon in any major role. I think also that Adam Powell has a choice. He has to decide whether he's going to do like the Southerner, whether he's going to keep his position in Washington by doing a daily, dedicated, visible work for Negroes, make a real contribution, or whether he's going to use a technique of the demagogue and stay in office simply by building up a straw man called the white man who's out to get them. And he's their great protector.
It's very funny how discussions of him provoke in some quite responsible Negroes the greatest evasiveness, unlike your reply.
Mm-hmm.
That's a really almost a test case of this. Mm-hmm. The refusal to pull away on that.
Well, they're afraid to take him on head on.
Wouldn't it could be in a discussion like this.
I've done it publicly.
I know that.
I'm not.
But I understand the other reason. I understand the other reason that in a war, and many Negroes conceive of this as a war, that you should not criticize anybody who's out cussing out white people for whatever reason. And there are a lot of Negroes who find Adam Pyle again entertaining because he acts like white people, and this is, they think, is a thing that's upsetting white people again. If white people didn't attack Adam Pyle so much, Negroes would not rally to his defense so much. If
it's true about Malcolm X too.
Yeah, but they do attack him, and as such, Negroes just get defensive any time a white person attacks a Negro.
This element's there. This is.
But
a,
I would like to say that
yes,
the
please.
Best example. Again, that established Negro leadership has the support when the issues really get serious and crucial, not facetious. Was the March on Washington, for example. Its success, which was spearheaded by the established organizations through their machinery, and the failure of the Stallions.
You we tie those two together as opposite sides of the same coin. I was about
right.
to ask you that.
You see, these are the only organizations, particularly the Urban League and the NAACP, that actually has the machinery in terms of local affiliates and established know-how in community organization and the basic confidence of the Negro community. You see, many people did not bring their cars to New York because they were not at all sure that an Isaiah Brunson could bail them out if they got put in jail and all this. So, again, there is an emotional reaction, which many reporters pick up and identify as these are the people speaking that Negroes are following and all this. But when it gets down to meat, bread, and potatoes, they show up at the Urban League office. When they really get in trouble, need a lawyer or something, they go to the NAACP. But as long as it's an entertaining evening, then they'll listen to some of this other.
Tell me this, how much liability has the white affiliation of the Urban League and the NAACP been, do you think?
Well, I think it's made us vulnerable to certain attacks, but I would think that it hasn't seriously hurt us, that deep down inside, Negroes know that they cannot go it alone. They cannot establish their own General Motors, their own A&P chain of stores, their own chain of banks, that we are dependent. Certainly, the two societies are interdependent. And the reason that I know that Negroes are never taking this type of philosophy seriously is that none of the people who espouse it ever suggest that they themselves will withdraw from all association and dependency on white people. Mr. Pyle, for example, doesn't withdraw from the Democratic Party, and Negroes certainly don't dominate it. He doesn't withdraw from Congress, and Negroes certainly don't dominate it. He doesn't turn down the salary that he receives from Congress, so I'm sure Negroes pay a very small percent of it. Malcolm X and the Muslims don't tell their Negro followers who pay them big dues that they should quit their jobs if white people are in charge. So it's not a consistent. Nobody says Negroes ought to move out of the houses unless they're owned by Negroes. So that it falls down at the level of serious consideration.
What about the role of, this poor fellow, the white liberal, who's been so beaten around the ears lately by Jimmy Baldwin and some others? Was called a plague and a nuisance and goodbye to and this. What is the role of the
white man in such a thing as the Negro revolt, revolution, movement, or whatever you choose to call it. What is his, well, his reasonable role?
I think the role of the white liberal now is to mass a real assault on getting the Negro included in basic social reform movement of this country. You see, the liberals' role earlier was to help to bring about, say, some of the social welfare measures and labor legislation, some of the things that went on during the earlier, the New Deal period of Franklin Roosevelt and all that. But when these things got established, then the labor, you see, became conservative, and liberals really had nothing to hold on to because they had not extended the social revolution to the Negro. In the sense that the Negro was any more than a partial beneficiary. He was not in the strategy or policy making. He had not been included as a participant in the social reform. Now, liberals missed a real bet, I think, when they did not immediately jump on the Urban League's proposal for a massive Marshall Plan. This is a point at which the liberal could have intervened and been very meaningful. Instead, he let the other people call this preferential treatment, and so the Negro situation moved on into some more extreme demands where the liberal found he could not identify. Now we're at a point now where the Negro ought to be able to say to the liberal, look, I'm upset about the discrimination in the labor movement, but I know that I must not be against the labor movement. I'm upset about some other things, but I know that we have to work together on the common goals of better housing and better education and better social legislation. In turn, the liberal ought to be able to say to the Negro that I am opposed maybe to the activities of the Triberry Bridge or the Stallings, but I am all for these other things. And on this we must keep together.
Now here's one of the points where some Negroes want to jockey the liberal into an all or nothing deal. So you've got to support the Stallings, the Triborough Bridge, and anything else, or you're out.
Yeah, but
this is a tactic that is used.
It's the tactics that's the problem.
I'm not sure it's a pure tactic. I think what we're witnessing here is a new group that suddenly finds some power and strength and influence, and it is able to attract mass attention. And it's a new experience to be able to, one, have this kind of group solidarity and be able to throw one's weight around and to be the constant source of all news story and television. And there will have to, there's a period of sort of tasting this and getting accustomed to it, and then I think the realization will set in shortly after the Civil Rights Bill is passed, after the signs are down, after Mayor Wagner and the governors submit executive orders and all this, and there will be nothing technical to attack, and the Negroes will still be hurting at this point. If liberals are now mobilizing to address themselves to massive remedial programs, there will be a point here within the next year when they will be able to come back together again. But I think the Negro is just like, you know, in some cases a person just learning to walk. He's trying out his leg. He doesn't want anybody to help him. He's just for the first time, and he's got experiences for a while. And the liberal will have to be not just tolerant and patient, but he will have to be mobilizing now to provide this other help that the Negro is going to need. And then when we get back together, he will have to insist on working with the Negro and in some cases letting the Negro provide the leadership.
The Negro must provide, clearly I should think, fundamental leadership. It's his show.
Well, that's as far as the basic civil rights are concerned.
Yes.
But when it comes to the basic social reforms that are needed in this country for all people, This isn't a question of the Negro providing leadership. It's a question of sharing and cooperative leadership of these people.
I was referring to the limited objectives of civil rights.
But you see what's happened is,
sure.
Even the very liberal papers like the New York Times came out and instead of grabbing hold of the Marshall Plan, they again called this preferential treatment. Now, at the same time, almost a few days later, they applaud the appellation, a special effort for these people. They urge that massive help be given to Alaskans after the earthquake. They applaud a special help to the Hungarian refugees and the Cubans. But with the Negro, they come back and say, no, he must be treated as an individual and not as a community.
Let's put it this way. What's wrong with an inclusive program? We will say with the highest percentage of the underprivileged in New York City are Negroes.
Yeah, well, this is what
but
we
make
have
it
said.
Inclusive, so it doesn't carry this liability, which it now carries.
Well, see, we didn't give it the civil rights community. The Negro leaders did not give it this label, preferential treatment. If you recall, this label was put on it by Stanley Lowell of the civil rights the mayor's committee. Commission. Now, what we called it was a special effort in the low-income groups with the people who are especially disadvantaged. Now, there are white people who live in those communities, and we were thinking, as Commissioner Keppel pointed out, he said, thank God for the Negro Revolution. It may lift the level of education for everybody in this country. And at this point, I think instead of the poor white voting for Wallace, as they did in Milwaukee, he should be applauding the effort of the Negro to get some of this because he will be the greatest beneficiary of it, you see, of improved education, improved housing for everybody.
Now, this is, I know this is your view, but somewhere, somebody has gone askew about this because the emphasis has gotten lost. Even among people who ought to know better.
Well, I wonder, is the emphasis, has it really gone askew? Or are we, for the first time, as the revolution has moved to the North, as the liberal in the North is now being called upon to express his real feelings, not just in terms of indignation about lynchings in Mississippi, but about people living next door to him, and about people going to his schools, are we now reaching a point where we're just beginning to get what the real feelings of people happen to be, and they're coming to the surface? I know the expressions at the Tri-Bear Bridge, for example, on the part of these commuters who were being delayed 20 minutes to get to their martinis out in Westchester. Their reactions were as vile, their language was as vicious and as vulgar and as hate-filled as any language that I had ever heard in Mississippi. And the hatred on their faces and the way they threw the things out at the car at the people would have done justice to any Klan meeting. Now, on the surface, we say, well, gee, this is terrible. This is too bad. But I wonder, ultimately, if you're going to get at the roots of a problem and correct it, don't you have to get at the real feelings of people? And for a while, it may look ugly. But what's happening here now is that all Americans are on trial to reveal either their great decency or their great evilness, their ugliness in its real form.
Do you find any truth in the speculation made by a good many Negroes in the South that the solution there, the crisis will be passed there long before it's passed here, and there's more basis for a rapprochement, for a working together there than there is in, say, the great metropolitan northern centers?
Yes, I'm one of these people who believe that when the South really gets over this hump of having to have segregation as a crutch to compensate for their other feelings of inferiority about the economy of their system and their lack of a lot of other things, once they get over this hump and they see that the Negro, they can't keep the Negro down without keeping themselves down, there's enough basic feeling tone and experience between white and Negro citizens that they will move off on a level unlike anything in the North, and it will be a much sounder relationship. You see,
many Negroes say this.
Well, this is
many say the opposite too.
No, I think this is based on a theory that the most vicious expression of hatred toward a person is to ignore him. It's not to hate him. It takes feeling to hate. That the worst way you the thing that destroys people is not to hate them or to love them, but to ignore them and make of their lives meaningless. I think the average Northerner, because of the separateness, and you know there's more segregation in housing in the North than in the South, that because of the separateness, because so few whites have had contacts with Negroes, that their feelings, this is largely an intellectual feeling, it's related to some abstract concepts of justice and equality. But they are still handicapped by a real experience with a Negro who's a peer, who's educated, where the average Southerner has had to deal with them. You see, you take New York City, there's only one Negro principal in all of New York City.
I know that. I've read it several times. Why is that?
Well, they contend that there are certain standards that that have been set up, and the Negroes have not been able to pass the exams, that Negroes who were capable have not worked toward this goal and not applied. This is the only city like this in the United States, and I don't know why it's anything unusual. I think it's because there hasn't been special effort made to encourage them, and if necessary, to set up realistic standards. I think maybe the test may be culturally skewed. And there has just not been this concentrated effort.
Nathan Glazer, I suppose whose heart's in the right place, says that there has been no discrimination in this. It's just a matter of the way the tests are set up and the way Negroes have just avoided them, haven't driven for this. It's a social accident.
Yeah, well, you see, this is one of the big problems in the North, is that they pride themselves on being colorblind, and this they set as their goal. But you cannot be colorblind today when color consciousness has been the history of the Negro in this country. And it's not enough now to be colorblind. For a while, we've got to be color conscious in a positive way. And I think too long New Yorkers have said, but all of our laws are right and all of our doors are open, but haven't provided a previously deprived people with the resources to take advantage of it so they could very comfortably open their doors and be assured that nobody could enter. And that includes a test to get to be teachers and principals. Mm-hmm. Instead of using the same skill and genius now to include them that they used to exclude them originally.
I know you are opposed to the quota system in hiring and other things.
Well, with
how do you relate that to the other problem?
Well, let me say I'm opposed to it in as a absolute general principle. But I would have to say, as it's oft time being discussed today, I would have to say that in the period of negotiation with a company, say, in a housing situation where no Negroes have been employed, or very few, that in order, because the institutions will take one Negro and say, see, we are integrated, the Negro leader is forced to discuss numbers in order to have any meaningful integration. Well, the minute we start discussing numbers, then people say, oh, you're for quotas.
So how do you theorize yourself out of this apparent contradiction? You see, I say it's apparent. I mean,
well, I would say that in the period of negotiation and transition, we are establishing a policy. We are changing a practice, and just as it has been artificially arrived at to begin with, when Negroes were automatically excluded, regardless. During this period of transition, in order to assure that we are actually changing the policy, we have to do this. But I'm only talking about the initial stages. Now, I would also take the position, the private position, not the public position, that quotas in certain housing projects that will assure that we will keep these integrated housing projects is a desirable thing. Quotas that would permit
what they call benign quotas.
Benign quotas. Now, my public position, it has to be opposed to this.
Right.
Yeah, has to be opposed to it because I reduce it to an individual situation where I would have moved into a neighborhood and because I saved my money, and then I'd say to another Negro who had saved his money and wanted to get better education and everything for his children, no, you have to pick out another neighborhood. This is mine. I have no right to say this. And so I'm publicly opposed to quotas per se. But I would think that we could talk less about quotas and spend more time on being sure that Negroes can move everywhere. I'll put it another way, that no white can escape. Then there's no need, his need to sell.
The pinch comes in a job, doesn't it? In jobs, doesn't it?
Well, I suppose so. This is basic, but you can't divorce this from man being prepared and trained to work at the job or from being in a neighborhood where you can get that kind of preparation and training. So you can't isolate any one thing.
No, everything is linked together in a way. But when you actually come down to the rub, to the negotiation, the job is where it usually gets tough, isn't it?
Yeah, and on this, no Negro has said, Leader, that he wants to see a white person replaced. What we are saying is this, is that we think there ought to be equal opportunity in unemployment as well as in employment.
Yeah,
and that we resent very much, you know, that we are 25% or 15% of the unemployed and whites are 5 or 6. And we think this situation ought to be changed. And that's why we're not buying, I'm not buying the saying that, well, the problem of unemployment of Negroes will be solved only when there's full employment for all Americans, because I know there won't be full employment for all Americans in the foreseeable future. And in the meanwhile, I don't think we can continue to have this large number of Negroes unemployed.
No, the ratio is preposterous.
That's right.
This is the end of tape 2 of the conversation with Mr. Whitney Young. Continue on tape 3, I say, hopefully.